Hello, I'm Matthew Bishop. Welcome to this new series of podcasts on inclusive infrastructure. Our host is InfraVision, the new think tank launched by Vauban IP. Infrastructure is fundamental to economic and social development, from roads and bridges to water and sanitation network to telecoms and internet. Infrastructure is the backbone of society. It's the foundation of so much of our economic and social activity. And increasingly, in recent years, there's been concern about inequality in the provision of infrastructure, both between the global north and the global south, and within countries and within cities, and between cities and the countryside. Infrastructure has risen to the top of the agenda both for governments and for the private sector companies that increasingly are expected to deliver many of the types of infrastructure that are needed to produce a society in which everyone can thrive and prosper. The focus of today's podcast is how can infrastructure operators integrate social and inclusive concerns into their core activities to create shared value for everyone, that is, to be more profitable and better businesses, at the same time as delivering better services for everyone. Our guests today are Javier Gier, who's Group Senior Executive of Vice President responsible for Performance, Impact, Investments and Finance of Electricité de France, EDF, Sergio Osley, who's COO of Telefónica in Spain, and Antoine Picon, who's Professor of the History of Architecture and Technology at the Harvard Graduate School of Design. Antoine, I want to start with you. Give us the big picture on this question of infrastructure and inclusion and inequality. What does inclusive infrastructure mean to you, and why has it risen up the political agenda and the economic agenda recently?
Large question indeed. I think first, let's start by the etymology. Infrastructure, there is infra in it, and it conveys the idea of something that is an essential support. It should leave theoretically no one aside. Infrastructure should be as inclusive as possible, and no one should be left out of it. And this was actually the promise of 19th century networks, from roads, waterways, and railways to urban parks. In many cities, including Paris or New York, parks were conceived as a technological network. The promise was that connection as broad as possible, was to make inequality tolerable. That was still, by the way, the promise of the internet at the beginning. Think of the story of the global village, in which everybody would be part of the global village, and this was a bit later on what social networks promised, at least at the beginning. So in practice, as we all know, things have been more complicated. Networks have often accentuated inequality of access and of level of service. And it has been the case in many cities, in many American cities, freeways connecting the downtown and its businesses to affluent, mostly white urban suburb have torn apart the black neighborhoods they went through. Just to conclude, I'd like to insist on one aspect, which is information. You know, Banerjee and Duflo, the Nobel Prize, note in one of their books that one of the sources of inequality is uneven access to information. So I think we have to couple infrastructure and widely spread information about it and its uses.
Why do you feel this has risen so high up the political agenda lately?
I think for various reasons. One is, you know, in developed country, we are facing a gradual crisis of infrastructure because infrastructure is aging, because also infrastructure has always revealed inequality. Take, for example, the digital. You know, the digital divide has appeared, etc. So I think this is, you know, clearly one of the motives. In the global south, we're still facing issues such as access to water and sanitation. In India, it's actually, for example, not digital. It's not the telco the problem. It's actually classic sewer and water and sanitation issues. So I think this is at the forefront of making society more just and inclusive.
Sergio, in the middle of the 20th century, it was very much seen that provision of infrastructure was the responsibility of the state, of government. But throughout the later stages of the 20th century and into this century, we've seen the private sector play a bigger role. From your perspective in the business world, could you share with us your vision of the concept of inclusive infrastructure and what you are seeing as the priorities to get from where we are today to that vision?
Yes, I mean, from the telco infrastructure point of view, the notion of being inclusive is fairly simple and can be translated into very specific targets. The way that we look at it is basically making sure that everybody can have access to ultra broadband wherever they are. In many cases, this is supported by mobile technologies. I mean, the coverage in most countries of 4G is almost universal, and in countries like our own, the coverage of 5G is almost universal. And even as importantly as in as mobile connectivity, we also need to make sure that you have access to fiber connectivity at your house that would ensure you have access to over a gigabyte of speeds within your house, wherever you live, whether it is in the center of a big city or in the middle of a rural area. I can say that Spain is a very privileged country in that regard. We have over 92% population access to fiber connectivity at their houses. And this, as you say, has been driven by the private sector, but also with the support of several funds and government initiatives in cases where maybe the economic incentive was not there to make sure that you could reach those areas with fiber connectivity.
And Telefónica is obviously a big player also in Latin America, where I guess it's there's less parts of the of Latin America are less developed than Spain. Are you seeing the same vision applying everywhere?
Yes, I mean, from a connectivity point of view, definitely. The technology in many of these countries or in some of the developing countries around the world will have to be different because they don't have a history of reaching rural areas with copper, with fixed connectivity. So in most of these countries, ultra broadband will be achieved or is being achieved through mobile technology. We do have, as Telefónica, the goal of reaching or making sure that 90% of the population in rural areas will have ultra broadband connectivity through mobile or broadband connectivity through mobile in 2 years' time. So we also are very aggressive deploying broadband connectivity in those areas.
Within the infrastructure sector, there's obviously a growing focus on inclusion issues, and companies are looking at their business strategy and how they embed action that does promote inclusion and equality, increasingly using the broad expression of impact, a term I very much like. Javier, you've been named Group Senior Executive Vice President of a new entity, the Performance, Impact, Investments and Finance Department at EDF. Can you talk to us about how impact relates to inclusion and social matters at your business?
Our goal via the creation of this new division within EDF is very clearly to convene and to join finance performance and impact performance, meaning social corporate responsibility. Of course, it's something very important in our organization because our goal is to give the evidence that a strategy for a corporate as EDF cannot be sustainable if it's not financially sustainable, but also if it's not aligned with planetary limits and social issues, and of course, if it's not part of a long-term strategic vision. So it's not something absolutely new, of course. As regards impact, I mean, what we mean by impact is corporate social responsibility. So meaning, of course, gender equality, meaning our impact on natural resources, our impact on climate, CO2 emissions, of course, all the scopes, and all these impacts that we have on our environment, and also, of course, the positive action that we can have in order to improve an institution.
I'm intrigued by how you brought together performance, impact, investments, and finance in one department, and I'm wondering, you know, what that's revealed in terms of, you know, breaking down silos and showing how these things are integrated with each other rather than, as companies often view them, separated into different bits of the business.
Yes, you've highlighted the key point. It's to break silos. You know, of course, all corporates look for finance performance on the one hand, and they're also looking for CSR performance on the other hand. But by bringing these two kinds of performances all together, we definitely align the different processes. For example, when we make a decision about an investment, we consider exactly at the same level CSR goals and finance goals. When we define bonuses, same thing. We have set goals as regards CSR, which represent 30%, for example, for our group and bonuses schemes, which are very comparable to the proportion of finance goals. So our goal is really to put at the same ranking both CSR goals and finance goals, and to join people in charge of that, in charge of this integrated performance in the same division, in order to be sure that they are all working under the same leadership, they are working along the same processes, and we will more and more integrate also in the same tools, the reportings that are, of course, required in both fields. So our goal definitely is to be more and more operational by developing this new organization.
Sergio, what about you? What does social impact mean at Telefónica, and do you measure your overall social economic contribution?
Yes, yes, we do. Social impact is one of our core values that drives. So we do that, and we follow. We try to measure in very specific numbers how much of a social impact that we have in what we do. We typically divide social impact in three areas. One is what we would call, and if more of the traditional one, our economic contribution to the economies and societies where we operate. There you have things like taxes, which these days they are kind of important, especially in the technology industry. For instance, the taxes that we pay in Spain per year, there would be enough to build 11 new hospitals every year in Spain alone. So that's a critical contribution to our economic impact in the societies that we operate. Also, we're lucky enough to be in an industry where there is a multiplying factor in how much the way that we operate. As we add connectivity to the societies, we increase the GDP of the society just because of the industries are very connected. For instance, we estimate that for every 1 euro that we get as gross margin, we add close to 4 euros to the GDP of any country that we operate in. So that would be one bucket, which is the economic contribution. Then, of course, we have the social contribution, and we follow that. Again, I think everybody understands that through technology and connectivity, the world can be much more efficient when it comes to our carbon footprint. And we have very specific targets in that regard. So we are aiming for net zero target by 2040, and we already recycle, we use all our equipment, what we do, and we already recycle close to 98% of all the equipment that we need to provide our services.
And Xavier, at EDF, you have a KPI which is called hashtag impact score, which is a 360-degree impact mapping tool. Can you tell us a bit about this?
Yeah, sure. I mean, in 2022, EDF was the first major group to self-assess and obtained a score of 68 out of 100 potential points on this impact score. According to the methodology of the Impact Movement France. This year, the group has improved its score to 72 out of 100, allowing for a 360 degrees evaluation and mapping of companies' impact across three pillars, and this is the key point. The first one is limitation of negative impacts. The second one is sharing of power and value, and the third one is positive impact strategy. So it's very operational, it's very comprehensive assessment, and this is also very innovative. And that's why some regions or some local authorities are also adopting the same indicator.
And if you look at the three pillars that you mentioned, did you find that performance was pretty similar across each of the three, or were there interesting variations?
Well, there are interesting variations because, in our activities, there are some natural impacts that can be negative impacts. For example, as regards biodiversity, when you develop new massive assets, of course, you had some impact, which may be negative impacts on biodiversity. So it's very important first to limit this impact and to assess very carefully the type of biodiversity you may impact, and then to limit by organizing the works, by organizing the asset, to limit the negative impact you may have, and then to develop some positive actions. It may give some different scores on the different pillars.
So we're at a time where people have used the phrase polycrisis, where there are sort of multiple challenges going on simultaneously, including a social justice and inequality challenge, crisis, and also a climate and biodiversity crisis. And Antoine, you've been one of the voices promoting the need for a new social contract that brings together both humans and the rest of the natural world in a way that helps us to restore cohesion. Could you explain this and what your thinking is here, and what the role specifically of infrastructure could be in this?
So the starting point of the reflection was the rise of what is often named green infrastructure, which is linked to the vision of nature as an essential support of urban life, probably one of the most important infrastructure today. It was connected to the idea that nature in cities is also a means to pacify society. It's not about health only. It's about, making society, making people happier together. And it's also a way to rethink what bounds us, what is the nature of the social link. So this is not an entirely new idea. It's an idea that had begun to develop in the 18th century. And in the 19th century, Osmanian Garden, but also realization like Central Park, were meant as tools to restore social cohesion. So now what's relatively new today in the age of the Anthropocene is the notion that a society is not only composed of human beings, but it also includes non-human beings. It was a key idea of the late philosopher Bruno Latour, who called for the creation of what he called parliament, in which these humans, but also non-humans, would be represented. So a lot of environmentalists have followed this path, calling for different way to make society by including plants, animals, and even rivers and forest. But now, interestingly, the same Latour insisted on the fact that we shouldn't divide the natural and the artificial, natural, non-human, and artificial one. Both play essential roles. And our society also connect humans through technological objects and system, and that include, evidently, infrastructure. So we have to understand that infrastructure is not something exterior to society. It is part of society. It materializes its relationship. So there is also an imaginary dimension in infrastructure. Networks in the 19th century were as much about dreams of connection as about the reality of connection. And interestingly, they were promoted initially by utopian thinkers. So infrastructure, I think, today correspond also to the question of the new social contract. So far, we've paid a lot of attention to green infrastructure, but energy systems and telco have evidently an important role to play. Both are about social life. To summarize, infrastructure today, from energy to telecommunication, is about how we make society and how we could imagine a society different from what it has been so far, and evidently more inclusive in every sense of the word.
And just to push you a bit further on that, I suppose through the United Nations COP process, we've started to hear a lot more conversation about biodiversity and the economic role of nature in society.
I think it implies a kind of bit, conversion of the point of view. technology used to think itself in nature, you know, taking place in nature, etc. We have to understand that today technology is part of the environment, that you have to think of biodiversity as one. You spoke of KPI. It is a KPI today. And we have, and I think most big companies are beginning to realize that this should be completely integrated in the agenda. And so I think it's really a dramatic change of paradigm that is about to take place.
As you say, it's a dramatic change of paradigm, and both on the social and, you know, the inequality front, but also on the climate front, there seem to be massive challenges. I'd like to ask each of you, what do you see as the priorities as we try and make these transitions, what they call the just transition that simultaneously moves us to a sustainable economy, but also one that's inclusive and has less inequality. And as we do that, is there too much focus currently on the green part of that transition and not enough on the more social stuff? Can I start with you, Sergio?
Yeah, well, I think that, the green transition is a necessary means for a broader transition that we also need to walk towards as a society, which is, as you referred to, a fair transition or just transition. From a telco perspective, I think the telco, and specifically the telco infrastructure, is going to be a critical, it is already a critical component of that green transition. We unfortunately all experienced that through the pandemic era, where we were able to live kind of a life through communications and technology. And it is obvious that that life, whether you like it less or you like it more, it's that way of conducting business is a lot more efficient. As an industry, we try to help our clients walk that path towards a more sustainable business model through connectivity, which is in itself becoming more and more efficient. So, for instance, when you look at the fiber technology, it's 80% more efficient than the copper technology. 5G is 90% more efficient than 4G. So there's efficiency to be captured from an environmental point of view, just looking at the technology of communication, but also trying to help our clients find solutions and product and services that enable that them to conduct their business in a more sustainable way, which will require or should require less physical waste. But to your point, Matthew, I think that even if we advance towards a more efficient way of conducting our own business as a society, which means that we would need to employ less resources to conduct our business, I think it's becoming very apparent that that is not enough. We need to make sure that no one is left behind, especially in a society that it's evolving from a technology point of view so fast. You don't even talk about generations. You talk about years. Now it's like if you don't keep up to date, the technology from 5 years ago, it seems already obsolete. So we need to make sure that we work on that as a society, and that we also put in place some kind of a social contract, as we were mentioning before, you were mentioning before, to make sure that there is enough digital trust so that everybody can take part of this new digital society that we're going towards.
Well, Zaria, obviously in energy, there's been a lot of attention on the just transition, and particularly, you know, what price socially is being imposed on the developing world and the global south if they're asked to accelerate the move to a renewable clean energy economy, when actually, you know, what's abundantly available to them are carbon-based fuels. How do we get the balance right between the social transition and the energy transition?
Of course, it's a key question. And green transition cannot happen if it's not a just transition, if it doesn't give access to everybody to infrastructure. So I really think that the first point is to develop adapted solutions from a technical point of view to the different local conditions. For example, as regards energy, we have a set off-grid solutions in order to enable our remote populations to get access to a limited quantity of electricity, but which is necessary for a day-to-day life. It's also very important to be able to set more structural infrastructures, but also with the contribution of large financial and multilateral institutions, for example, such as a World Bank Group, Asian Development Bank, or African Bank of Development, for example, because they contribute to the financial competitiveness of projects. And this is very helpful in order to develop a win-win architecture for investors and for the end customer. For example, we have emblematic investments like the dam in Laos, which at the time it was developed represented circa 85% of Laos GDP, and allows it to have controllable, decarbonized, and at low-cost electricity. So I really think that it's very important to have these capacity first to set the and to make the right technical choice, and secondly to also be able to structure from a financial point of view this project to make them affordable to everybody.
Antoine, back to you. What for you are the biggest challenges we need to be focusing on right now in terms of delivering this kind of just transition?
Well, like Sergio and Xavier, I'd like to start by the fact that social justice is a condition of the green transition. And this is what the pandemic, it was already said, told us. We live on the same planet. And if COVID is raging in slums, it will sooner or later reach well-off districts in a city. I would probably insist on two things. The first is that this transition is a political process. And this is, you know, there is a political dimension to it. And the second, it's probably because in France they're a bit common, that anti-technological attitudes do not solve the problem. And I would completely agree with Xavier. We need technology. We need more agile solution. Energy grids that can function at very rapidly varying regimes. So I think this adaptability, this agility is a quick question. I think at the intersection then of politics and technology, we need design. I'm in a school of design probably, so I'm going to advocate for design. We need to design systems, but system in close association with the social relationship that they imply. I think today, engineering is both technological engineering and social engineering. And this is what, for me, this is one of the conditions for the green transition to succeed, a more socially oriented technology. And, you know, all that I've heard from Sergio and Xavier, I think, go in that direction.
Sergio, Telefonica is now the world's top-ranked ICT company in digital inclusion, according to the Digital Inclusion Benchmark. Can you just talk briefly about what are the main commitments you've made at Telefonica that have put you at the top of that list? And what else do you need to do?
Many things, I guess. I think that part of what we're trying to do over there, the kind of like the way that we approach it, is that we have a very specific plan. It's a very orderly plan. We have committed ourselves publicly to reaching over 100 million premises covered by FTTH, so fiber to the premise, to the home, by 2026. We have also committed ourselves to having 100% of our products and services being accessible by design, so from day one, since they are drawn on paper, sort of by 2025. We already talked about our commitment to bring connectivity mostly through mobile means to rural areas in across Europe and Latin America. We're good at our promise to bring 90% of mobile broadband connectivity by the end of this year to all Latin America, for instance. So I think it's a mixture of just make sure that we're all organized, we're all aligned. We have some four very specific areas where we like to work on and try to come up with specific actions to do to advance in all those four areas, and they have very global targets that are publicly communicated as a way to commit ourselves to that.
Xavier, we often talk about energy insecurity in the global south, and that's been a huge priority for policymakers. But even in France, some 3.3 million households are suffering from energy insecurity. What do you see as the main things that can be done to address this?
It's first a major question, which is more and more sensitive, in particular since 2022, because the prices were increased massively, not only in France, but also in the UK or in different European countries. For example, in UK also, there were some demonstrations with one motto, which was "Don't pay your bill." So clearly, this is a massive political, social, economic question. I mean, I really think that on that matter, you have two different types of actions. First, you have some actions to be brought forward by the regulators and by the governments. For example, in France, we have a mechanism by which there is a tariff equalization. This mechanism ensures access to electricity at the same price wherever you are in France, even in the French overseas departments and territories. And in this way, there is no disparity from one consumer to another, even if the cost of producing and transporting electricity may differ. Another example is the agreement that we struck with the French government in November last year, in order to organize the market design from 2026. And this agreement means that above a certain market price, EDF will be taxed on its profits, which can be then redistributed to consumers. And this is the main lever for ensuring that electricity, which is an essential commodity, remains affordable to as many people as possible. Another example is that during the massive crisis in 22 and still 23, the French government decided to set a tariff cap in order to protect the end consumers. So clearly, governments have important levers in order to contribute to the affordability of the electricity. On the other hand, of course, corporates can also develop their own actions. First, of course, we all must be very competitive as much as possible. And we can also develop some specific actions. For example, EDF decided 2 years ago, more or less, to end power cuts in case of unpaid bills. And we prioritize power limitation. And EDF's goes beyond, of course, our regulatory obligations. Or another example is that we seek solutions for our struggling customers thanks to over 200 solidarity advisors who spread across the country, respond to requests from households with payment difficulties.
Antoine, I wanted to focus on the role of cities in addressing this inclusive infrastructure challenge. As an expert on urban planning, could you share your vision of how we can build more inclusive cities and make cities that we call them smart cities now, are smart cities inclusive by design?
I think smart is a good entry into that question of how to build more inclusive city. Definitely smart city are inclusive by design. I think, you know, the notion of smart cities has been with us for something like 50 years, and we can now begin to assess what has happened. The first thing it has revealed is there is no technological determinism, and we've seen the rise of different types of smart city. We've seen very top-down smart approaches, you know, really putting the accent on, you know, the kind of cybernetic, like, you know, for management of things versus more bottom-up. We've seen smart city which are more state and municipal versus others which are more business-oriented. So, you know, if we talk about inclusivity, one could be tempted to be simplistic and to say that bottom-up is preferable to top-down, and public authority may be better than businesses, but it's actually more complicated. A metro system is definitely better run in a top-down way than in a bottom-up. So the question is probably the mix, not which solo orientation to prefer. I think if we want to fight inequality, we have to invent original combination between all these orientation, and we have above all to put individuals at the center, which should not be too difficult because smart city, actually the digital is centered on the individuals. I think in summary, yes, inclusivity is by design, and we've seen it in other domains. For example, Vienna launched, you know, the gender mainstreaming experiments, and we now know that, you know, if you want to really be inclusive with women in our cities, we need actually to really, by design, you know, think differently.
Sergio, we're talking about cities, but actually COVID-19 did bring home actually that maybe the future doesn't necessarily have to lie in cities, and that people want to get away with, to the countryside where they're less exposed to certain types of risk. And I think that also highlighted perhaps some, you know, serious inequalities in access to infrastructure in rural areas in all parts of the world. How do we get the balance right here, and what, how do we get inclusive infrastructure in places where that may be more costly to deliver?
I think that it has to be a combination of private investment and some support by the governments, just to make sure that the business case makes sense for the company that's investing in that area, to make sure that they have enough connectivity. Because for sure, the business sense, when you look at it from a society point of view, even if you just look at the economic indicators, it makes a lot of sense. For instance, all the things that we have seen ourselves when, because as I mentioned before, in Spain, many, many rural areas, they already have 100% fiber coverage. And what we've analyzed and realized is that once you get to the 100% fiber coverage in a rural area, it has impact in two very specific economic indicators. One is the unemployment rate. So we see a 0.8% decrease in the unemployment rate in that area, which is quite significant, I would say, because it's almost completely linked to the deployment of the of a new infrastructure, the communication infrastructure. And then one of the other things that we see is that there is a very tangible increase in household income in that area, which is roughly 4%, which again might not seem like much, but it's, I believe it's quite relevant considering that it's mostly linked to just the arrival of that new infrastructure. So it does make a lot of sense, not just from a you may call societal point of view or a fairness point of view, but also from an economic point of view when you look at the overall business case. And I think one of the things that we'll have to reflect upon is, because we've experienced that through the pandemic, is the role, not so much of the rural area, but also of the urban areas. Does it make sense to live in an urban area for some people when now you can virtually work or be entertained or be educated from anywhere in the world?
Xavier, we're almost out of time, but I wanted quickly to ask your input on the question of how you engage with other stakeholders around these questions, and what you've learned from your experience on the Stakeholder Advisory Committee at EDF. Is this a game changer to talk differently with your stakeholders?
Well, yes, we've organized a Stakeholder Advisory Committee, which is made up experts who provide their critical perspective, you know, on the group's strategic orientations regarding CSR, and definitely they represent the expectations of civil society. Their strengths and the interest of this body is their diversity, the fact also that they provide us with complementary skills, that they offer so fresh look at the group's activities, being outsiders but definitely very interested in our activities and on the consequences and stakes of these activities. For example, there are economists, there are climatologists, there are human rights specialists, there are experts in social and solidarity, economy. So, you know, it's very useful to have them on board because they are absolutely independent. They are great experts in their field.
So I'm going to give you the last word to you, Antoine, picking up on a topic that you've touched on a couple of times and which we could have probably focused the whole podcast around, which is artificial intelligence and this current phase of adoption of that, and whether you see this as likely to help or hinder the provision of inclusive infrastructure. Maybe be provocative as we wind up.
Yes, it can definitely help. But we know at the same time that, you know, artificial intelligence is inseparable from a series of problems. One is, for example, energy consumption. We'll need to find ways to train artificial intelligence that is probably a bit better in terms of energy consumption. Another is social and racial bias. We know also that the training very often reproduces the bias of the trainer. So we need to find ways to address that and probably, you know, to have watchdogs on those issues. So that's another thing. I would say also that, you know, we have to realize that the future is not only AI, it's AI with people. It's AI, it's hybrid assemblage of people and AI. So we have to think in some ways, how do we reassemble the social so that we create productive hybrids between human and AI? And I think if we follow already these three tracks, you know, more energy efficient, because what would be the use of claiming that we're becoming green if AI, you know, by a kind of Jevons effect, pretty much annihilate all the progress we've made, you know, something, find ways to fight against bias, and finally think of the human dimension of the use of AI, I think, yes, it can definitely help, and I'm actually quite optimistic. I think just to conclude, you know, sociologists who study, for example, the extreme form of inequality like slum have coined the term people infrastructure to mean that actually one of the reasons slums still function and sometimes they can be very productive is because of people network, etc. I'd like just to go back as a conclusion to the fact that infrastructure is about people. It is about sociability, and this is what we have really to integrate today.
That's a great positive note to finish on, and this has been a fascinating conversation. I think it shows that the challenges of delivering an inclusive infrastructure is a huge and important one that has many, many different facets and nuances and will keep us all very busy for many years to come. I'm Matthew Bishop. I've been delighted to talk with my guests, Xavier Agier, Sergio Osle, and Professor Antoine Picon. Thank you.